from the whatever trail the comets were on. So even so, some of that debris is moving at maybe 100,000 miles an hour. A big effect is if we hit it at a 90 degree angle, wherever it is, it's actually the main speed is really the Earth hitting the particles. You know, they could almost be standing still, and we're moving into it, and our speed is roughly 66,000 miles per hour. So you're going to have a minimum speed of that usually when you encounter these meteors. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I'm going through the calculation right now of how fast the Earth moves around the sun. I think it's around 19 miles per second, and I should know that in miles per hour. And that's a pretty swift velocity. So, although the meteors move pretty fast, too, many of these meteors are comets that are an elliptical path that goes around the sun, and when they dip in close to the sun, they boil off all kinds of materials, and those materials become a cloud around that comet, and in many cases, the Earth encounters that cloud. We intercept that cloud, and thank goodness we don't intercept the comet itself. That would be a pretty serious event. That would give you a nuclear winter. And there have been impacts on the Earth, obvious by what you see at Meteor Crater, Arizona, and there are portions of the Yucatan where they believe a meteor hit. And I think there's a great big depression in the ground in Canada. There's a couple of places where the Earth has been hit in earlier times. Shoemaker-Levy 9 was a real good-sized comet that had it hit the Earth, it would have done a lot of damage. Lucky for us, it hit Jupiter, and in the process made some nice big black blotches on Jupiter as it hit. Jupiter is a very nice protective shield for us. An awful lot of the things that would hit Earth hit Jupiter first. Anyone else with any questions or comments before we move on to the deeper stuff? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
2ZFX. C2QIQ.
I heard something like ZFX and then Glenn in that order. ZFX, give me your full call and name, sir, and then proceed with your question or comment.
KB2ZFX, name is Daniel, and I'm coming in clear, then I have a quick question for you.
You're coming in very clear, Daniel, so go right ahead.
Okay, I'm sure I should know this, but I don't, so I think I'll ask. Basically, what's the point of having the tone on a repeater? Why is that necessary? And number two is, I'm using an old HT. It's HTX202, and it actually has a tone for both transmit and receive, which I've never seen before. So I was wondering what the deal with that is. Thanks.
Now, this particular repeater, right now during the TechNet, is being hooked up to EchoLink, IRLP, is probably another computer mode, and the repeater itself is also tied in with the Eastern repeater at Selden, Long Island, as well as this one in Queens. So a certain amount of time is required for all of that resetting to take place. If we make a transmission for more than roughly a minute and a half, we get a warning saying that we've timed out the repeater. So to have the right amount of time for all of that resetting to take place, the operators of this repeater have set up a series of four tones. So many of the times you'll hear four tones. Let me drop.
The question you asked, Dick.
Now, we've also got a PL tone requirement. Let me drop. Yeah, I just did a transmission without my PL tone beyond 11 o'clock. This repeater must have a 136.5 hertz PL tone, 4Z PL tone. Otherwise, the repeater will not repeat that signal. And there are repeaters that also have a tone on the output so that people could have a squelch receiver that only hears that particular repeater and nothing else. Sounds like Howie's got more information you'd like to know. Go ahead, Howie, K2LIW.
The reason why you have tone on a repeater is so that if you're in an area where you might have skip or you are in a crowded area, you don't want to key up multiple repeaters, so you have a bunch of tones, like 38 tones, and they're all EIA standards. Like this is 4A, which is 131.6, you know, 136.5. 2A is 114. So PL tone was originally set up so you can basically not have interference, and you can run the squelch wide open, basically. So it's very sensitive. And now they have newer types of stuff, DPL and other kind of coded squelch. Go ahead, Dick.
Along those lines, this particular repeater shares the exact same repeater pair with Torrington, Connecticut, and Frenchtown, New Jersey. So depending on the condition of the band, a person like me with an antenna on 100 feet of tower on 300-foot high land, my signal might be picked up by those other areas, and I'd be opening up repeaters that I don't intend to talk to. Over to you, Daniel. KB2ZFX in Far Rockaway, K2RIW. And by the way, do you know Barry? N2 Moon Bounce. You got it, Daniel.
Yeah, Dick, Barry and I, we've met before. We've talked a bit. He has quite a setup. Yeah, it definitely clarifies it somewhat. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, John, I know that one of the things that was being discussed from time to time, I think Glenn had a comment too. Glenn, did you get a chance to make your question or comment? KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, Dick, actually, I guess when my question was, I was listening to a lot about, the meteor showers and the effect on Sporadic E and everything, but sometime last week, I think it was Tuesday, there was a solar eruption on the sun that sent forth a really large solar cloud, and for anybody who's working the low bands, it really, really lit everything up, and I think it really started taking effect toward just before we started getting those lightning storms towards the end of the week. But it was really, really incredible, performance on HF. And I guess what I was wondering was that when you were talking about the meteor showers before, did I misunderstand? You said it was possibly the meteor showers that caused that solar activity to start up on the sun? back to you, the K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, not at all. As far as the sun is concerned, a huge gas ball of material undergoing a beautiful nuclear fusion operation for the last 5 billion years, has got 5 billion more years to go. When a ordinary sized meteor crashes into the sun, I think the sun basically says, so what? It's a minor event. So does a meteor shower affect the solar prominences and solar bursts and coronal mass expulsions and whatever? I doubt it. That's a very minor event. You can calculate how many tons of material is being converted from mass to energy in the sun during each second, and it's a huge number. By the way, the speed of the Earth around the sun is 18.5 miles per second, roughly 66.7, let's call it 67. 67,000 miles an hour is the rate of speed or velocity of the Earth in our orbit around the sun. So if the particular meteor cloud we were hitting just happened to be sitting still, it still would encounter the Earth at nearly 67,000 miles an hour. Choose a few hundred thousand miles an hour that the meteor itself is moving, and you can get some very nice closing velocities. So some of these meteors really come in at pretty high speeds and give you some very nice ionizations. And so the guys who do meteor scatter ham radio, they can talk to some pretty long distances, I think numbers like 1,500 miles. With high-speed digital data, you can send that data during the couple of seconds that the ionization is present and the propagation way beyond the horizon is taking place. And you use relatively broadband Yagis when you do that. You don't want to have the antenna too high in gain, otherwise it's lighting up too small an angle of the sky.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
HWW, Dick.
If your Yagi that you're using for meteor scatter is too high in gain, you're lighting up too small an angle of the sky, and you have too low a probability of hitting the meteors, you're better off with a much broader angle. Go ahead, Howie.
Thank you, Tom. And as far as the F-skip, I haven't noticed that much F-skip on 10. A lot of E-skip, but not real F-skip. A lot of, like, in the Midwest and this kind of E-skip. But I haven't noticed a lot of F-skip. What have you noticed? Do you think this last eruption gave us any F-skip? because I haven't noticed any at 28 to 30 megs. This cycle doesn't seem to be as exciting. And the only thing we have is really East Kip. A couple of months ago, we had some F openings to Arizona, New Mexico, and South America. But we haven't seen any in the last couple of weeks.
Make a comment on that?
Go right ahead, Glenn.
Howie, just to give you an idea, last week, I think the event happened, it was an M2 event on the Sun on Tuesday. By Thursday, Wednesday night and Thursday, let me put it to you this way. I started just calling CQ, because I was hearing a few stations coming in on 20 meters, and this was like 10:30, 11 o'clock. I could stay on all night long and talk worldwide. I mean, it was just stations. And originally I had my amplifier on, and it was ridiculous. It was getting so uncomfortable operating because it was just pile-up on top of pile-up that were coming back at me. So eventually, just to try to wean off and get away, I kept on turning my power down and down and down. I think on 20 meters at 11 o'clock at night, I was still talking worldwide with about, I don't know, about 50 watts of power. And then 40 and 80 are just all over the place. I mean, with 25 watts, I can talk right into Europe. It's been incredible. I mean, I haven't seen performance like this on the low bands, for quite some time. Let me pass it back to you, Dick. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Don't think the MUF gets up to 30 megs.
Glenn, what was your best guess as to the type of propagation you were experiencing? And make a rough guess as to how long ago is the last time you saw anything like that. You got it, Glenn.
I would have to say I was a teenager, Dick, when I started hearing performance like that. And of course, my radio and my antennas are far better today than they were back then. But I mean, this was like ridiculous. I mean, it was getting to a point where I didn't even have to steer the beam very much. I had three-way conversations going on between Middle East, Canada, and the West Coast, and from all different directions. And it was like I was on an omni, and I had my beam basically favoring the Mid-East, just a little bit south of east of my home QTH here. What's interesting is that at different what I noticed is at nighttime, 20 meters is really alive right now. Where it used to just like after like 5 in the afternoon, it would just kind of like all fade away. Now it's just lit up all day long. The other things too are like even I'm noticing even as high as 2 meter, not so much on 440, but just very very strange propagation. But that could be the sporadic E. But it just really has appeared very very strange this past week. Back to you, Dick.
15 meters.
So you're describing what you heard on 20. Is there anything like that going on at 15, Glenn?
Yeah, all the bands are definitely more. In other words, they may settle down a little bit, but they're still every band an HF is enhanced. Even if you turn it on now, I'm sure that if you were to go on 15 and call CQ, somebody's going to come back to you, and it's going to be DX. Especially if you're, using even just moderate power, you're going to hear something. Just to give you an idea, there was a guy in Ohio on 20 meters with QRP, was talking to a station in the Mideast, and it was a little rough for him, but they could hear him, and I heard him at my home QTH over here, 10 over 9, 10 to 20 over 9 on. What I'm interested in is, what is it really doing up on the higher frequencies? Is it really? It must be having some effect there, but I'm just not sure how much, because I am noticing a little bit more DX there, but it's more like you're saying sporadic. It's not as hot as it is on the HF bands.
Glenn, do you have the ability to also listen to 6 meters, 2 meters, and 432 during these DX periods and find out where this effect is stopping, so to speak?
To me, they're all more active. That's what's crazy. 6 meters, it pops in and out, but it never popped in and out like this in quite some time. Right now, you can, if you're a little bit patient and you can wait an hour or two and listen around, chances are it'll open and close at will, and you'll hear things come in all over the place. Certainly I'm even hearing it up on 2 meters. I honestly have not been on 440 sideband, but I'm going to try it again this week and see if there's, these conditions really still hang in there.
HWW with a comment.
Howie recognized Glenn. What kind of DX have you heard on 6 meters in the last period of this enhancement?
Well, just from the mobile in the car, you know, commuting back and forth to work, I turn it on just to listen a lot of times, or at lunchtime, I kick it on, and I've been hearing mostly all continental United States, just about everywhere, Canada, continental United States, everywhere, from all everything from the West Coast, all over the place, you know, and it just pops in everywhere.
So you're telling me you're hearing double hop to the West Coast on 6 meters.
Oh, yeah, and then some.
You skip, Dick.
Yeah, that sounds like sporadic E, but even so, West Coast, it takes a double hop to get there. That's pretty significant. Go ahead, Howie.
I don't think I've heard F-skip. Barry, because he's got humongous antennas. Barry is worked into England and Europe on 6, but that might be F for all I know. But Barry has been working England a couple times this week.
Is that as far as he's gotten into Europe? Just England? Hasn't gotten in any further to Europe, do you think?
But he said he heard a bunch of stuff. I think he heard England, maybe France, and that's about it. But he said it's weak. It's like S1, S2, like barely above his noise floor.
Now, changing subject a little bit, Glenn, I heard you discussing earlier this week two things that I'd like to add a couple of words to. Number one, when you've got some kind of a high voltage generator that's going into something like a Tesla coil, and in order to excite the Tesla coil, one of the ways they do it is with a spark gap. So you've got some kind of a generator, some kind of a step-up transformer in many cases, and you're putting a few thousand volts into the spark gap, and that goes into the primary winding of the Tesla coil. The secondary winding has its tuning and its huge voltage step-up. And hopefully out of the top of that you get the hundreds of kilovolts and maybe even approaching megavolt type voltages. And in order for that primary excitation to really bang the living daylights out of that secondary resonator, what they tend to do is to have the primary source of power, which really is a secondary of a step-up transformer. In some cases, for the really potent guys, they're using a pole pig transformer run backwards, you know, taking the 220 line back up to 1,300 volts or 4,000 volts. Let me drop. That in turn goes into the spark gap, and the output of the spark gap goes into the primary winding of the Tesla coil. And in many cases, you will see a very low impedance as far as equivalent series resistance is concerned, a fairly high quality capacitor across the winding of, let's say, that pole pig transformer, which is firing the spark gap. And you asked, what in the world is that capacitor doing? You also asked the capacitors across the spark gap itself. That's a separate issue. But the first capacitor, in my opinion, is trying to lower the instantaneous impedance of that, let me call it a reverse pole pig transformer. In other words, when the spark gap does ionize, the voltage across that spark gap can easily go from, let me pick a number, 4,000 volts, and it jumps down to about 20 volts. It's got a huge negative resistance characteristic where a big slug of current can happen into that primary winding of the Tesla coil, the bottom winding. But in order for that big slug of current to take place, you want the equivalent source impedance for that transient event, the source impedance, which is the pole pig transformer secondary, primary, you know what I mean. You want that to be a very low impedance. So by putting a capacitor across it, and because the laws of physics are, you cannot instantaneously change the voltage across a capacitor. So whatever voltage was on the transformer, like it might be the peak of the sine wave at 4,000 volts, and you got 4,000 volts on that capacitor, and the spark gap ignites, now, no matter how many amps it takes, essentially all of that 4,000 volts will be impressed across that primary winding of the Tesla coil. If that capacitor wasn't there, the equivalent resistance, the Thevenin impedance of that pole pig transformer winding with its series resistance and distributed inductance and whatever, would not give you instantaneously anywhere near...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
The instantaneous impedance of the source would not be anywhere near as low, therefore the slug of current going into the primary of the Tesla coil would not be anywhere near as large. You get a lot more performance out of the right kind of capacitor across that winding of the primary source. Does that make some sense, Glenn? That's the way, that's my guess as to what's going on with these Tesla coils. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Glenn, if you remember, the capacitor was on the secondary side.
Yes, I do. I guess a lot of these circuits, I guess, you know, these diagrams that came from Tesla, and I guess what started a lot of this conversation, Dick, was that there were some diagrams that Wesley had, you know, forwarded, and I guess you might have been listening in the background, but pretty much what, when you look at some of these diagrams and they try to explain what some of these tests were, it's very, very difficult to, because I'm not even sure that at that time they had all of the same, the same schematic symbols and everything that are available today. So they kind of sketched them the best way that the, I guess that they could to explain what their circuit was in these patents or in their notes. And when you look at them, at these diagrams, and I guess the person who had, you know, put this little paper together, let me let it drop for a second. It was the person who did this, it was something called like Pepe's Pages for Tesla's Notes or something, and they didn't really put enough information in there to explain what the, what the frequency of the input signals were, what the current magnitudes were, the voltages. It was a very, very loosely described sketch, and what was happening was Wesley was asking a lot of questions, and I had like nothing to refer to, and I just started picking components, and I'm like, what is their actual function? I think you might be right about that one. But I wish for those specific diagrams, there was more actual information on the experiment itself, if you know what I mean, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I have a comment on that that will explain everything.
Glenn, if I was using a Tesla coil today, a high-performance Tesla coil, and I wanted to give you quantitative information of what takes place on each individual spark gap breakdown, and if I was using a modern-day, really high-performance oscilloscope, and I'm using a very high-voltage, what I call Flash Gordon probe, one of these probes that's got a million-to-one ratio to it or something like that, which can tolerate the high voltage at one end without arcing over, give you a good representation on the screen as to what the voltage waveform looks like. At the instant of breakdown of one of these events on one half of the 60 cycle going into the primary of the Tesla coil, you might have 4,000 volts, 10,000 volts, something like that, across the spark gap. The spark gap ionizes at the peak of the voltage or near the peak of the voltage in probably a few picoseconds, and maybe even less than a picosecond. The voltage on that spark gap goes from 4,000 volts down to probably 20 volts. Huge DVDT takes place. And if the Thevenin impedance and the equivalent inductance back to the primary source, which really is the secondary of the transformer, if that has a low enough instantaneous impedance, because it also has a very low inductance, very low equivalent series resistance capacitor across it, even though it's only a fraction of a microfarad, still instantaneously that voltage can't change. As such, now, all of that 4,000 volts that used to be across the spark gap, every bit of it appears now across that primary winding of the Tesla coil. And then that event lasts for, let me pick a number, a couple of microseconds. And then from then on, the spark gap extinguishes and all kinds of ringing effect takes place of the resonance of both the primary winding of the Tesla coil and the secondary. And that waveform itself would be a nice, clean sine wave. It's a bell that you've rung, except that now the arcing that takes place at the top of the Tesla coil gives you another kind of arcing phenomena that has nanoseconds of events to it. So with modern-day instrumentation, if you and I spent $100,000 in instrumentation, I could measure these events. You and I know that the instrumentation they had in those days was nowhere near a fraction of that. I mean, the oscilloscopes they had in those days didn't do a very good job of demonstrating audio voltage waveforms. And as such, they could tell you by diagram, I set it up this way and it worked well, and I set it up that way and it didn't work well. But if you wanted quantitative information of volts and amps and amperes and the Gausses and Oersteds and Webers and Teslers and whatever, wow, you're in trouble. Over to you for a comment on that one, Glenn. K2LIW.
Yeah, I have to agree, Dick. I mean, I think, though, that there is more information there available than it would, you know, than just, you know, I can't believe that they went through all that sophistication to just look for a little illumination, and that was the end of it. I'm sure that there had to be a little bit more scientific process to that study, especially, you know, with people like Mr. Thompson who were involved in some of these experiments and Tesla. You know, there's more to it. You know, it's just unfortunately the way that those pages were put together. It doesn't really explain enough about the experiments, you know, themselves. And, you know, certainly in today's day and age, too. I mean, heck, if we wanted to create an experiment like that, you wouldn't even need the Spark app. I would just design a transformer with the right coupling and turns ratios and have an electronic generator create those pulses. Do it directly. You know, like you're saying, you know, they just, you know, used what they had or what they figured was going to work. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I got a problem, though, Glenn. It's quite possible that when that spark gap breaks down, the instantaneous current there might be 1,500 amperes. It's only there for a microsecond, but that instantaneous current is 1,500 amperes backed up by a 4,000 volts of that charged capacitor all being dumped into that primary winding of the Tesla coil. What kind of a signal generator would you use to generate that, and could you afford that, Glenn? Go ahead.
I'd build it. And yes, I could definitely afford it. But I bet you I could do it on less than $100.
Hold on now. Let's assume that I want 8,000 volts peak, and I want to discharge it into the primary winding of the Tesla coil. And when I discharge at 8,000 volts peak, 1,500 amperes flows for a few microseconds. Is that a silicon-controlled rectifier? What kind of a device are you... Yeah, a gas-filled, really super thyrotron could do that. But what kind of solid-state device with modern-day equipment would you use to do that? And you would like to do that 120 times per second without it burning up. I'm not so sure that's quite as easy as you think. Although maybe you work on some pretty stoochy stuff. Over to you, Glenn.
Well, I'm assuming that all of that is what I call single-quadrant waveforms. In other words, they're really not AC waveforms. And in other words, I could definitely get those kinds of things to fire. Now, there are certain circuits like ladder circuits, I'm sure you've seen them before, that are basically voltage doublers and quadruplers that can be used in a ladder network. And if you size your capacitors correctly and with the correct rectifier scheme and voltage triplers and quadruplers and these kind of you know, ladder type of circuits, they can be driven with very, very low impedance, well-coupled transformers. So first I would have a very, very well-coupled, high-frequency transformer and basically switch it at whatever frequency. And I can actually make it pretty broadband, too, so I could change the switching frequency. Now, to create the 8 kilovolts, I could certainly do at least, you know, a couple of kilovolts and then just have a divider, have the ladder network on the output filter to drive the, you know, the very, very high rise time pulses up to 8 kilovolts. Sure, why not?
Okay, now I'm going to give you some information that blew my mind today. Maybe you'll be as excited as I was. A buddy of mine who lives in Texas has a good friend that I know, a mutual friend named Barry Malawanchuk, VE4MA, a retired guy who worked for the Canadian Hydro System in Manitoba. You've got this great big dam with a hydro station generating, I'm not sure of the exact number, but I'm going to guess it's in the vicinity of 600 megawatts of raw electrical power. They have to transmit it 1,000 miles. They did it with two wires. One wire is plus 500 kilovolts. The other is a minus 500 kilovolts DC. So 1,000 miles away, out of this wire, plus 500 kilovolts and minus 500 kilovolts, megavolt peak to peak, they put that into a set of silicon-controlled rectifiers. It used to be thyrotrons. The thyrotrons were as big as a pair of 40-gallon oil cans welded together. That's what the thyrotron used to look like. Now it's done with solid-state devices that are a couple of inches in diameter, and they're stacked up with a great big long string of these things all in series. Let me drop. And these silicon-controlled rectifiers have to be fired at just the right instant of time, all of them fired just right. And let's assume that you've got, you're standing off a half a megavolt with silicon control rectifiers, so you've probably got, I don't know the exact number, but maybe you've got 1,000 of these damn things all stacked up, and you want to fire them all correctly. At first, you and I would do that with 1,000 little isolation transformers. They did it with a burst of light going into each of these silicon control rectifiers by way of fiber optics. So each of the silicon control rectors are fired at just the right time with pulses of light for this inverter that has to take 600 megawatts of megavolt voltage and convert it into a 60-cycle sine wave. Have you ever heard of an inverter like that, Glenn? And they've got two or three of them side by side on standby because occasionally they get a failure. And when one of the failures they get is one of those half megavolt lines, the positive line or the negative line, fails, and therefore they have to operate with one single line against ground. Let me drop. And they're able to tolerate that failure condition, but they only have like a one quarter of the power output when they do it, and some of the city goes into a brownout. But at least they can do it by using ground as the common terminal across this 1,000-mile range. But there's a catch. When you use the earth ground, your grounding equipment is being eaten up by galvanic action, and sometimes it'll eat away the tower, it'll eat away everything you, in the ground you've got. They obviously want to operate in that condition for very temporary periods of time. The majority of the operation is they're running on the plus and minus half megavolt, 1 megavolt peak to peak. Ain't that an inverter? KC2QIQ, would you like to work on a system like that? K2RIW?
Yeah, power transmission is really amazing stuff. Back, I guess, in somewhere like around 90 or 91, when I was working for ABB, I came up with one of the very, very first optocoupled drives. And the purpose of that was for the German Bundespost. They had a telecommunication system that ran on a, what was their main, the power main, I think, was 480 volts was in three phase. And in order to, like, I mean, even if you just were to look at the corona buildup and what kind of, you know, dielectrics you'd have to put into the drive transformers, it was just a waste of time. So basically I came up with this fiber optic scheme that we were using basically for voltage feedback also, because instead of using large voltage dividers, we can actually use the fiber optic feed to send the isolation feedback to the primary again, where we actually do the primary control power. So there was a lot of fiber optic cable being used back then, and it was a very, very interesting thing. And as long as the customer was willing to pay for it, it was good to go. But unfortunately, in today's market and day and age, nobody wants to pay for such things. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Fiber optics these days, though, are getting very high in performance. You can send a fiber optic signal with no intermediate amplification across the whole non-Atlantic Ocean. And I think they're using the so-called soliton mode when they do that. But so there's a very low insertion loss fibers, and I think it was some kind of a flash xenon flash tube that was making these flashes that were going through the fiber optic cables that are firing these strings of something like 1,000 silicon controlled rectifiers all in series with each other, all being timed just the right way, and something like 1,000 or 1,500 amperes was flowing through these silicon controlled rectifiers. The big question I got is, firing the silicon control rectifiers to do an inverting function. If it was a silicon controlled switch, I'd feel a little bit more comfortable. But in the case of a silicon controlled rectifier, and you got DC input, the only way you can make the silicon controlled rectifier go into the non-conducting mode for the second half of the cycle is that the firing of another string takes over and releases the first string. And if you get a failure where the firing of the second string for some reason doesn't release the first string, you've got an awful lot of smoke and flames in a hurry. And we're talking about lots of megawatts here. So, boy, can this do destruction in a hurry. And the actual mechanism by which a burst of light fires a silicon-controlled rectifier, I'd like to know a little bit more about that. I'd love to see some pictures of this thing that I've requested. And how in the world they do enough filtering to make the harmonic content of the output of this inverter. Let me drop.
VH4YY.
Joe recognized. I am guessing this inverter is making a staircased waveform, and that in turn has to be filtered. And can you imagine doing a 60-cycle three-phase filtering of 600 megawatts of power? What kind of an LC network does that look like? Wow. Joe first. Go ahead, Joe, and then we'll pass it over to Glenn for a comment on this one. Have H-U-R-Y-Y, K-Q-L-A-W. Mother Nature is going to be a little bit nasty, and she's going to hit your wire. So how in the world do you build a surge arrestor for the 10 megavolts of impulse that takes place from a lightning bolt on a 500 kilovolt DC wire? Can you imagine building that particular surge suppressor, Glenn? And can you imagine what's required at the 600 megawatt level, three phase, to do filtering of what comes out of that inverter? No matter how many steps you make to that staircase, it's still going to have a ridiculously high harmonic content if you don't filter the living daylights out of it. KC2QIQ, there's an engineering challenge for you. K2RIW.
Well, the lightning protection, actually the traditional way of doing it, is basically with standoff insulators. I mean, generally, the idea there is that if you look up at most of the very high, large power transmission lines, they're really held off with these monstrous, I mean, they look like very, very small, like little egg-shaped type of insulators. If you ever come up close to these things, they're actually monstrous. Some of them are actually two and a half, 3 feet in diameter, and they're stacked, 12, 15 of them, one right on top of each other, standing off these lines from the towers, that you don't have any electrostatic or galvanic effects between the wire running down the transmission line in those towers. So isolation and spacing is usually one of your best protections there. The filtering, well, there's no free lunch with 60-cycle filtering, Vic. It's huge. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Hey, Glenn, how would you like to do not only filtering, but power factor correction at those kind of power levels and voltages?
I love it. It's actually a blast. I can tell you an interesting little story. This week, I came up with a very, very cute little circuit for, instead of using a boost converter, for doing some fairly decent power factor correction. And it's basically a passive circuit. And it really just has two filter capacitors and three diodes after a bridge rectifier. And I was able to get basically 0.9 power factor from 90 volts AC input to 264 volts AC input on a very, very low power, like a 12-watt circuit, and be able to maintain power factor better than 0.9 without any power factor correction active circuit stick, just a passive diode and capacitor network.
At your leisure, you got to send me a schematic of that. That sounds like fun, if it's not proprietary information. Is there prior art on that one, Glenn, or do you think that's a QIQ original? What do you think, Glenn?
As far as I know, Dick, it's not proprietary. The guy who did come up with this circuit, his name is Spangler. It's called the Spangler circuit. And I've seen it, and it's been ignored a few times, I guess mainly because people couldn't really get the efficiency out of it, and they didn't get necessarily as good a power factor as I was getting. And, I figured I wanted to see what I could actually do with this, and we actually had some experiments in the lab last week where we have an intern that came in for the summer, so I had him wiring up some new circuits for me, and that was one of the ones I had him try, and we were measuring line harmonics and power factor correction, and it was well within acceptable limits. I was very, very impressed.
At my leisure, I'm going to look up a Spangler circuit. Sounds like fun. One of the things that I heard as a discussion during the week was the E field and H field, which you guys were calling E field and B field, E field and M field, but I call it E field and H field, of an electromagnetic wave. And if I've got an electromagnetic wave, or I've got an electrostatic situation, like I've got the output of a Wimshurst machine or a Van de Graaff generator, DC voltage, I can measure that E field in the vicinity of that instrumentation, in instrument of that vicinity of that generator. With the right kind of instrumentation, I could tell you, for a static field, what is the volts per meter. That's the magnitude, in my opinion, of the E field. In the case of an electromagnetic wave, even though the wave is continuously changing, goes positive and negative on each half cycle, so on the positive half cycle or the negative half cycle, I could rate its magnitude in volts per meter. So E field, to me, can be measured in volts per meter, whether the situation is static or dynamic. I was hearing some words that led me to believe that there's two different kinds of E field, whether it's static or dynamic. And except for the RMS problem of definition of magnitude, RMS versus peak, I think they have both the exact same E field, is my first guess, but maybe I was misinterpreting. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Well, I guess what happened was last week, one of the discussions that it came up was, we were talking about electromagnetic waves and basically magnitudes of, BH curves. And what was happening was the E was being replaced with, like, electrostatic versus H. And I'm like, no, there's no electrostatic there. That's flux density. And then it was like, well, what happens when it's moving? You know, like in free space, like an EM wave. Well, the flux density is varying in amplitude against frequency. But that's not electrostatic. That's just all magnetic. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, when it comes to the signal coming out of an antenna, and by the way, there's something that NASA did this week, and I hope Paul is still with us, where the Voyager spacecraft, which are now, I think, I forget how many billion miles are out, but I think they're like 2.5 times the distance of Pluto. They are starting to see some very weird cyclic magnetic field bubbles. They're seeing magnetic field bubbles at near the magnetopause, or whatever it's called. In other words, as you go far enough out of the solar system, the magnetic wave, the particle waves, the magnetic field, and everything else emitted by the sun and all of its wild gyrations is no longer a steady state group of particles, so to speak. It's now starting to form individual bubbles. And it's a little bit like what would happen if I was taking a great big long ribbon and moving it in a complicated manner. The end of the ribbon moves in a funny way compared to the beginning of the ribbon. Well, you got this long ribbon of particles in the solar wind coming out of the sun being affected by the magnetic field, the instantaneous magnetic field, which is continuously changing on that rotating sun. By the time you get out there at twice the distance of Pluto, you start seeing the breakup of those individual magnetic lines, and they reform into local bubbles, and the Voyager spacecraft are driving through those bubbles and sensing them. I wonder if you've read that this week, Glenn. Go ahead.
No, unfortunately, I haven't, Dick. That's on the NASA website?
Yeah, I think it's called Space Weather or NASA Weather, something like that. If you Google the right words of Voyager spacecraft and magnetic fields that they're measuring, you'll find it. And so they're finding these bubbles. Ordinarily, the magnetic wave that's in the near field of, let's say, a radiating dipole, some of the diagrams and some of the animations, applets that I've seen, try to picture what happens as the beginning of the radiation of a wave out of a dipole. And they show it as closed loop magnetic fields that locally are closed, and that the way they close spreads out into bigger and bigger circles, so to speak. And by the time you get into the far, far field from that dipole, you've now got the condition where the H field is, in my case, for a vertically polarized wave, the H field would be purely horizontal and the E field would be purely vertical, and it's a planar sheet of energy coming toward you when you're in the far, far field. Up close, though, all of those magnetic lines must close on each other. And even the magnetic lines on that far, far field, it may look to you like they're not closing. but maybe somewhere out there in infinity they are closing. And in the case of the magnetic field at the far, far field from the sun's solar wind, the Voyager spacecraft are both seeing these magnetic bubbles of completely closed local magnetic field in the vicinity of what the spacecraft are diving through, even though those fields were never closed like that as they were first emitted from the sun. I think you get a little bit of the picture as how complicated this is and having a little bit of trouble figuring it all out. Over to you, Glenn, K2LIW.
Yeah, I saw that, the WS2N. It's still on the website, NASA website.
Okay, give Glenn the email address for that, Paul. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's just NASA.gov, www.nasa.gov, and then they have, there's always a half a dozen things that pop up. You'll see in the flash, they have a flash program for each main topic, and it's probably about the fifth one in now. As every day goes by, they have another one, and then it gets put to the back, But if you have trouble, then you can always put in Voyager, or Voyager website, their homepage, and they always have the latest information, and they have it there as well. Back to you there.
Okay, I just found it. It's called A Big Surprise from the Edge of the Solar System. That's the name of the article. It's at NASA Science News. And I'm trying to find... NASA Science News is what it's called. And if you look, if you go to http://science.nasa.gov/science-news, you'll find it there. Maybe that's enough of a search engine now that you know something about it. Over to you, Glenn, for a fill on that. K2LIW.
Yeah, no, very good, Dick. I'm trying to type it in right now, see if I can come up with it. Because I've never heard the terms magnetic bubbles used before. So I'm kind of, it's caught my attention here. Let me see if I can type this in and come up with something here.
Very, very good. You'll eventually find that. We've given you enough search words. You'll eventually find it by Google or whatever. But here's what I see happens. It is my belief, not a single electron leaves any of the antennas that we build, per se. The current flowing through the radiators is being enhanced in magnitude of current by way of resonance. Without the resonance, we get very little radiation. To really get efficient radiation out of something like a dipole or even more complicated antennas, we're using resonance. And therefore, the amount of current we're pouring into the antenna is relatively small. But the circulating, resonating currents within the antenna are 10 or 100 times greater than that, depending on the Q of the antenna. So by resonance, we're getting a huge multiplication of current somewhere within the antenna. That current creates a reasonably strong cyclic magnetic field. By Maxwell's equations and Lenz's law and everything else, Faraday's law, the rate of change of magnetic field creates a local E field at right angles to the rate of change of magnetic field. So from my point of view, the very first step in the radiation of an antenna is current flows, current creates magnetic field gets pushed out into space. That is the beginning of the radiation, and Mother Nature, within a wavelength or so away from the antenna, she straightens it all out. The rate of change of magnetic field makes a local E field. And that local E field, that instantaneous cyclically changing E field, does not require any electrons to be there. Let me drop. In the case of the E field that I make in the vicinity of my Van de Graaff generator, I got a positive ball that's being pumped with 100,000 volts, a whole lot of electrons are being sucked away from it, and it's highly positive. And I got another sphere alongside of it, which is highly negative. So I got a whole lot of excess of electrons on one sphere and a lack of electrons on the other sphere, and I call one of them positive and one of them negative. But in the space in between, I've got this huge E field that I can measure in volts per meter. But it doesn't require electrons in space to make that E field. Yeah, there really is a little bit of conduction going on because the air is not a perfect insulator. But that's a secondary effect. I can have that E field in a perfect vacuum with not a single electron there. So this electromagnetic wave does not require electrons. That's the first thing that some people get confused by. and the magnetic field itself, the rate of change, is making that E field. And the electromagnetic wave itself, I heard you guys discussing it, let me drop. And you were correctly saying that for a vertically polarized wave, for instance, the E field is up and down in some number of volts per meter of peak on each individual cycle. And the H field, the magnetic field, is horizontal at some amount of magnitude of amps per meter at again, a cyclic rate. We talk about the peaks of the RMS, but there are two of them. The H field and the E field are exactly at right angles to each other, but there's another catch. It's very easy to say that the E field and H field are trading energy back and forth to each other. That almost does not compute. Good common sense. I put an inductor and a capacitor on the table. I connect the two together in parallel. I bring my grid dip meter near there. I find the resonance. And during the resonance of an LC network, yes, the energy does trade back and forth. At the instant the voltages peak on the LC network, all of the energy per se is in the capacitor, 1/2 CV squared in joules, and no current is flowing in the inductor. There's nothing in the inductor. A quarter of a cycle later, as the voltage goes through zero, the rate of change of voltage is maximum. The current through the capacitor is maximum. The current through the inductor, which is identical, is maximum. The magnetic field is maximum. So, in the case of a LC network, the energy of inductor and capacitor trade back and forth 4 times per cycle. Ain't that crazy? But they trade back and forth. In the case of an electromagnetic wave, it ain't that simple. If I could transmit an electromagnetic wave through space, I'm a long distance away from it, it's a pure planar wave, I stop time and look at it. What will I see? Let me drop. I'll see bundles of electromagnetic energy. I go to the peak of one of those bundles, where the E field at that particular Z location, Z is my direction of propagation, I've got this plane of observation that I'm slowly walking through the Z domain, the Z axis of the stationary wave. I've stopped time to study it. And I slide my plane of observation to the point where the E field is maximum. And the E field is straight up and down, volts per meter. At that exact location, the H field is also maximum, horizontal. H field is maximum. E field is maximum at the exact same point in space, at the exact same instant in time. I move my plane of observation a little bit further, a quarter a wavelength further, where the E field goes through zero because it's about to reverse polarity. At exact same location, the H field is going through zero because it's about to reverse in polarity. So I got these bundles of EH moving through space at the speed of light. Each of the bundles is a separate entity, so to speak, and there's a dead space in between each one of them. Of course, that doesn't make sense at first, but let me show you why it's got to be that way. Let me drop. We're about to get the machine identifying itself. We're going to get a little bit of an interruption. You know that the pointing vector allows you to predict how strong is the electromagnetic wave and in what direction does it propagate. The pointing vector says you do a vector cross product. You cross E into H. And as you cross E into H, if you're moving from, say, for instance, 12 o'clock on my vertically polarized wave toward 3 o'clock in my horizontally polarized H field, I'm crossing E into H. I'm doing that rotation in my vector cross product. If that was a right-handed screw, the direction of advance of a right-hand screw predicts the direction of propagation. So far, I think you can almost see that. Let me drop. Now, when I've got these bundles of energy, where the peak of E and the peak of H occur at the exact same point in space, and I cross E into H, I know the magnitude of the wave, the electromagnetic wave. I know how strong it is in watts per square meter. And I know the direction of its propagating. If you had the opposite effect, and one-third of the world gets this one wrong, there's a whole bunch of websites trying to correct this, and sometimes they succeed, where they think that the energy of E and H are trading back and forth between each other. If I had a 90-degree phase shift between E and H, so that I choose the point in space where E is maximum and H is zero. Very similar to what happens inside of an LC network, which is not an electromagnetic wave itself, per se. But if in free space, I've got this 90-degree phase shift that many people think exists, look at the problem you'd have. I choose the point in space where E is maximum, but H is going through zero. Because H is going through zero in the middle of the maximum E in this erroneous diagram, one is reversing a polarity, H, but E is not. If I go a little bit further forward from that, I get one particular polarity of H. I go a little bit back from that point, I get the opposite polarity of H. If I calculate the pointing vector for the forward half of that bundle and the reverse half of that bundle, I get two opposite directions of propagation of the so-called pointing vector. I can't possibly be right. It doesn't propagate in two directions at once. Every reasonable electromagnetic wave in free space propagates in one and only one direction. I wonder if that makes some sense to you, Glenn. KC2QIQ, you're allowed to challenge all of the above. K2RIW.
I'm following you, but I think that there's just something that is bugging me about what you're saying. I guess it's just when you're talking about E and H, and when I talk about E and H, I'm not sure we're on the same page. I mean, to me, the E field, or it could be expressed in units of Gauss or Tesla, and H is Oersted's, and, you know, that E, B, whatever you want to call it, in that direction is flux density. H is the magnetic field itself. It's a dimension. You can actually convert it into ohms in free space. And, you know, here again, of course, as one goes up, the other one goes up. It's a dimension. They're not different energies. It's just a dimension of a magnetic field. Now, if it's alternating and going plus and minus, as one goes plus, the other one's going to go plus. As one goes minus, the other one's going to go minus in phase because it's a dimension. It's like a square getting larger and a square getting smaller. Do you follow what I'm saying, Dick? K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
We've got a problem, Glenn. The FCC, among other authorities, also the Institute of Electrical and Electrical Engineers, the C95 report, the American National Standards Institute, when it comes to measuring maximum permitted exposure, it is in three sets of units, and you will not violate all three sets. Let me drop. Yeah, you could say it's four sets of units. But when it comes to human exposure of electromagnetic RF energy, you've got a rating in specific absorption rate, watts per kilogram, which can also be related to power flux density, milliwatts per square centimeter. Those are two of the units, magnitudes, you will not exceed. There are two other sets of units you will not exceed. One of them I think you're going to be in agreement, certain number of volts per meter, a correction, amps per meter of H field. The maximum H field at this particular frequency, and I got a chart, you will not exceed that number of amps per meter of H field. But the E field is in units of volts per meter, not Oersted's. Oersted is a magnetic component. Weber is a magnetic component. Tesla is a magnetic component. Kilolines per square centimeter is a magnetic component. Oersted is magnetic. You look in your dictionary. Oersted is a magnetic characteristic. E field is measured in volts per meter in those very well established documents. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
It would have to be, because basically if you look at all instrumentation, let's say you're going to make these measurements and we're going to be in a 50-ohm system and we're going to use something like a watt meter or a spectrum analyzer or something to do it, you have to put something in the way of that field. You've got to intersect it so to determine that it's there. So you're going to put a small antenna or a detector or something inside of it, and it's going to be copper. And the minute that gets in the way, once that piece of copper or detector gets in the way of that electromagnetic field, EM wave or whatever you want to refer to it as, it's going to intersect, and all of a sudden current is going to flow through it again. and then there will be a voltage intensity and a current intensity, and that could be measured against a detector and measured on a voltmeter or a wattmeter. So, I mean, you can get, that's how those units convert. But in free space, when that electromagnetic wave is moving, I don't see anything other than electromagnetic, the K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.